Hi. Sorry, I was on mute. Okay, so pleasure to be here again. And so now we're going to be thinking about mental health issues. And here I'm partly speaking as a doctor, but I'm also, to be honest, speaking as a patient, as a consumer. So a number of years ago now, over 15 years ago, primarily as a result of the level of stress that I was carrying, had become the most senior consultant on the neonatal unit, and I was desperately trying to hold everything together. And I had two special areas of expertise. One was brain injury, and the other one was ethical problems. And so I had accumulated a whole caseload of intractable, challenging, and difficult cases, and I felt I was the one holding it all together. And something I've sort of learnt is that if you put people under intolerable stress and you turn up the stress day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, eventually something snaps. But what it is that snaps is rather unpredictable. So it could be something physical, so somebody may suddenly have a heart attack or a stroke or something physical like that. It could be psychiatric. And someone suddenly has a breakdown or develops psychiatric symptoms. It could be moral or ethical. And somebody suddenly is involved in something which is completely atypical and out of character. They do something, they're involved in some kind of immoral behavior or actions. And in my case, it was psychiatric. And I suddenly started developing really quite bizarre psychiatric symptoms. I started having hallucinations, and strange things were happening in my head. Interestingly, one of the patterns that you can discern is that the thing which cracks up, the area which cracks up, is often the area where the person feels strongest. So it's the long distance runner, the marathon runner, the guy who is incredibly fit, who then goes and has a heart attack. And it's the person who is known for an incredibly righteous and upright behavior who is then discovered to be having an affair or to be fiddling the books or doing something quite out of character. And in my case, I was known to be, I was thought to be the person who was psychiatrically the most stable. I was the rock and the stable person on which, and at one point or another, virtually all of my consultant colleagues had wept on my shoulder, and I was the rock. I was the one who was holding it all together. And then suddenly, bam, I was nowhere and ended up in a locked psychiatric ward. So these are issues which touch a lot of us, and mental health issues, as you know, are incredibly common, and they seem to be rising in incidence. And that includes in the Christian church. So it's something that's very close to home for me. But I have realized that although it's been a very painful journey that I've been on, and one of, there's been a lot of suffering, and for those who haven't had psychiatric illness, it's very hard to describe the intensity of the suffering which people go through, particularly with severe depression or other forms of mental illness, that yes, there's physical illness, there's the pain of, you know, of all kinds of physical things, but actually the pain of psychiatric illness is something uniquely horrible. And it's, as someone called it, it's a pain of the heart. It's a sort of internal suffering, which is hard for people to understand. But I've realized that actually, by God's grace, it's also been a strange kind of gift to me, that through the whole experience of going through this period and then finding my own healing, it's given me resources and ways of helping other people, and also a new understandings about suffering and about redemption and so on, which I wouldn't have had. And so much so, you know, that if you were now to offer me the possibility of going back 15 years and just wiping the whole thing out, and I would just carry on as a consultant and none of that would have happened, I wouldn't take it. it's actually, I've learned more about God, I've learned more about the gospel, about what it means to be human, about the nature of suffering and psychiatric illness through these experiences, and I wouldn't swap it, I wouldn't go back. And it's just another example of what I believe passionately, that there's nothing that can happen in your life or in my life which God cannot redeem in some way, that he cannot turn into blessing and healing. But, you know, the movement from suffering and pain and agony to blessing and healing doesn't happen automatically. It actually requires our participation. It requires us to be part of that process and collaborating and allowing God to work that process. And I've come to the conclusion that part of the process, and perhaps it's the most vital part of all, is that the journey from suffering through to blessing and healing goes through the Garden of Gethsemane. And that there's a sense in which each one of us is going to be called to go through the Garden of Gethsemane. And it's the prayer that Jesus prays, "Father, if it be possible, take this cup from me, but nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." That is the prayer, the Gethsemane prayer, that unlocks the process. As long as I'm hanging on and saying, "No, I don't want this, I don't want to do this, I don't want to go this route," we're blocking the possibility of healing. But if we can only say, "Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done," and mean it, and sometimes we have to pray that every day of our lives, that is the way that unlocks the fact then that God can use that and allow us to be changed. So mental health issues are real and challenging, and it's quite alarming. I particularly work with students and medical students, and it's quite alarming to see how the rise of mental health issues. This was a survey in 2015. 78% students said they had mental health issues. 33% said they had suicidal thoughts. And one of the sad things is that if you take non-heterosexual students, so these are gay students, homosexual, transsexual, you know, LGBT group, the incidence of suicidal thoughts is significantly higher. So these are very real issues. There's a huge amount of despair, suffering. It's important to remember that, you know, when you just see the demonstrations, you see the harsh stuff going on, just remember how much pain there is underneath and the despair. And these were some of the symptoms. You probably can't read it all, but stress was the highest, feeling unhappy or down, lack of energy, anxiety, depressed feelings, feelings of hopelessness, worthlessness, insomnia, irritability or anger, sudden mood changes, panic, numbness, thoughts of self-harm. And more than half of these among students, again, said they'd experienced mental health problems, had not sought any help. So again, that's very common. And I'm sure there are people here who've got mental health symptoms, but actually you haven't told anybody, or you're not prepared to ask for help. So I think one of the important things to understand is that actually mental health problems are remarkably common in God's people, and often in the people that God particularly uses. And you only have to look throughout the Bible to find all kinds of issues. So suicidal thoughts. Do you remember Elijah, who said, "It is enough, God." You know, now he'd had the great, it's classic, he'd had a great success. God had really used him in a demonstration of his power. And then Jezebel says, "I'm going to kill you." And immediately he goes into a deep depression and says, "It's enough, Lord, take my life." But God doesn't come along and say, "Okay, I'll take your life." Instead, he sends him on a sabbatical. And he has to learn that actually God's got more plans for him. Job, who curses the day he was born, Jeremiah. So suicidal thoughts are common. Thoughts of despair, of hopelessness, of anxiety, of stress, of fear. again, David, but in the New Testament, there's Paul. There's Paul telling Timothy not to be fearful. There's Joshua who feels he can't cope. And depression, why are you so cast down, my soul, the psalmist in Psalm 42. So we shouldn't think that this is something new or unusual in God's people, nor should we think that if we are having, or we know people who are having mental health issues, that means they can't be used by God. It seems almost that God specializes in using people who have mental health issues. And I recommend this book, if you're interested. It's called Genius, Grief, and Grace. And it's written by a Christian psychiatrist called Gaius Davis, and he just gives short biographies of prominent and influential Christians, all of whom had mental health issues. And if you just look at that list, Martin Luther, John Bunyan, William Cowper, Lord Shaftesbury, Gerald Manley Hopkins, and so it goes on, J.B. Phillips, C.S. Lewis, Martin Lloyd-Jones, all people who struggled with mental health issues. And it's a tribute to God's redemptive power, the way that he uses people who are weak, people who struggle, often in a special way. So we talked earlier on this morning about how God has designed human beings. And one of the wet things is that God has designed us to be incredibly complicated. That's why medicine and the healthcare professions are so difficult. Because frankly, human beings are complicated. They are simply not straightforward. And in biblical thinking, every person is a unity. They're a single person, but they have four different aspects. They have a physical aspect, they have a mental aspect, they have a relational aspect, and they have a spiritual aspect. And lo and behold, if someone gets ill, whatever kind of illness it is, all four aspects are involved. Whatever the illness is, even in a common cold like me, in a small sort of way, like what I've got at the moment, that every aspect of my personality is being affected. And the same is true with mental health issues. So it's just helpful to think through these four levels if we're thinking about mental health issues. So first of all, at a physical level, our brains consist of biological mechanisms and processes. We have neurotransmitters, brain chemicals. We have synapses, which are the connections between the nerve cells. And these, when people have mental health issues, there are actually physical changes in the brain. There are physical changes in the chemicals. At a physical level, I was having hallucinations because particular pathways in my brain were being activated or overactivated due to excess of a particular neurotransmitter called dopamine. And then if somebody could, for instance, have a brain injury, it could be that they've been involved in a road accident or something else, and so the brain itself is damaged physically. And then there are things like drugs. Some medications are also abusive drugs, drugs like marijuana and cocaine and heroin and so on. And all of these change the physical nature of our brains. Alcohol is another drug which changes the brain. Caffeine even has an effect on our brains. Medication we take from the doctor, fatigue, lack of sleep, all of these things are involved in health, in the physical side of us. Then there's the mental side of us. So you just think of all the things that are going on in our heads mentally or psychologically. There's the emotions, there are memories, there's stress, there's thoughts coming into our heads. There's reactions to events in the past, maybe as a child or things we've seen. Maybe we've been abused. So many people, my wife working with female prisoners, she says that virtually every woman in the prison has had abuse as a child, and often it's been something that's gone throughout the whole of their life. Often they've then ended up with an abusive partner. The whole abuse cycle just carries on. There's boredom, there's pornography, and other things which people are exposed to, all of which affect our minds and our thinking processes. And then there's the relationships we've had. and the effect of our relationships with our parents and with our siblings and with our friends and partners and colleagues at work and strangers and celebrities, even relationships with animals people have. And then finally, there's a spiritual side of us, our relationship with God, our awareness of sin, guilt and shame, temptation, demonic and evil influences, fear of death and judgment. So all of these things are going on. And the strange thing about us is that all four levels interact. So for instance, you can start off with a purely physical problem. So for instance, if someone gets very bad flu, the effect of flu, it can be to change your neurotransmitters in the brain. Because you have change of the neurotransmitters, that changes your thoughts, and people can become depressed and lose energy, and everything's too much hard work and so on. Because of that affects number two. That affects number three, so their relationships are now all distorted, because instead of, you're no fun anymore. Now you're always depressed, and so their relationships are damaged. And then they may start to feel that God is punishing me, or I'm feeling terribly guilty, I can't read my Bible, I can't pray, I feel terrible. What's going on? I feel distant from God. You see, so that started off as a physical thing and affected, but then it can work the other way. So you could start off with a relationship problem. Someone has a divorce or they have a terrible marital breakdown. As a result, they become depressed. Because they're becoming depressed, that changes the chemicals in their brain. And that also affects their spiritual relationship, and so on and so on. So can you see how these four layers interact in incredibly complicated ways? And whenever you're trying to help someone with mental health issues, you need to think about all the four levels. You need to think about the physical, you need to think about the mental, you need to think about the relational. And actually trying to unpick it all is often incredibly difficult. Which came first? Was it really the flu that came first, or actually was it more the fact that I was already having relationship difficulties that made me more open to getting the flu, or was it that there was a spiritual aspect? It's very difficult. This is why we're so incredibly complicated. But I've realized, and many other people realize it as well, that the best approach is usually to tackle all four factors at the same time. So if you want to help someone with mental health issues, then you need to think about all four areas. You need to think about the physical side, and that may be as basic as getting enough sleep, going for a run, getting out in the open, having a regular exercise, doing all the things that mummy said you should do. Or it also might be taking medication, which actually changes the chemicals in the brain, taking antidepressants. In my case, I have to take an antipsychotic agent, which actually controls the level of dopamine in my brain. So at a physical level, I had to learn, and that was a terrible blow for me to actually discover that I actually needed to take medicine. Then there's the mental level about our thought life. How are we going to control our thought life? And sometimes that's just talking to friends and loved ones and having cups of tea and something. Sometimes we need more specific talking therapy. We actually need to go and see a psychotherapist or a counselor. I had psychotherapy with a professional counselor who was very experienced in treating doctors, and it actually turned out to be incredibly helpful, helping me to reflect about my work patterns and how I could change them in a better way and why I was feeling the way I was feeling and so on. Then there's relational therapy. So one of the things that happened to me is that because of it's only after my breakdown that I realized how much the way I was living was damaging my relationship with my wife and with my kids. And I hadn't really noticed that because I'd been so preoccupied with my work. So after my breakdown, you know, we had some heart-to-hearts, Celia and I, and then we decided to go off and do the marriage course at Holy Trinity Brompton and sort of rediscover one another and re-find our relationship. And in many ways, I think Celia would say, and I think I would say, that our relationship is better now after all that has happened than it was before, because we were forced to undergo this kind of relational therapy. And then there's spiritual therapy. Sometimes we need to restore our relationship with Christ. We need to find forgiveness. We need to maybe need a spiritual, a wise friend, a counselor, a pastor, or somebody who can help us to restore these. And the important thing is it's not one or the other. It's not, well, shall I do A or shall I do B? I think you've got to do all four, because that's the way God has made us. All of these things matter, and they all go together. But one of the ideas I found very helpful is an idea of mental hygiene. So we all know about physical hygiene. We all know that we are expected to wash our hands every day, and particularly after we've been to the loo and before we eat food. And we know that just because I washed my hands yesterday, that doesn't mean that I can't wash my hands. I don't need to wash my hands today. And what's more, I'm going to have to wash my hands this evening. I'm going to have to wash my hands tomorrow. In fact, I'm going to have to wash my hands every single day until I die. And if we accept that that's perfectly, when, particularly on a baby unit, you end up washing your hands 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 times a day. I'm very good at washing my hands. If that's true for physical hygiene, then it's also true for mental hygiene. And the idea of mental hygiene is that we can monitor what we think about. What are the things that are preoccupying my mind? And then choose deliberately to focus our thoughts on helpful and positive things. And because I did this yesterday, I'm going to have to do it today, and I'm going to have it to do tomorrow, and I'm going to have to do it every single day of my life. I'm going to practice mental hygiene to keep my thoughts healthy. And lo and behold, there's a wonderful example of mental hygiene in Philippians, where Paul says, "Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about these things." And it's a really interesting list. It starts with truth. So we deliberately choose to focus our minds on what is true and not on what is false. So mental hygiene starts with focusing our mind on the truth. But secondly, it focuses on things that are goodness, things that are good. We focus our mind on things that are good as opposed to things that are evil. And so honorable, just, and purity are all examples of things that are goodness, focusing on goodness and filling our minds with things that are good. And then third, the final ones are all to do with beauty, with things that are beautiful, things that are lovely, things that are admirable, things that are excellent, praiseworthy. So it's about truth, goodness, and beauty. And it is deliberately choosing every day, day by day, to fill our minds with those things instead of things that are false, evil, and ugly. And the point is that we have to take control of our own thought life, and we have to do it positively. You know, we all know that you can't decide to not to think about something. If you ask people, "I don't want you to think about an elephant," the one thing you can guarantee is everybody's going to be thinking about elephants. It's impossible not to think about something. So how do we not think about the evil stuff? Answer, positively, you say, "I'm going to think about the good stuff. I'm going to think about what is true." So my challenge to you is, this is something for everybody, not just for people with mental health issues, how are you going to practice mental hygiene in this coming week? What techniques can you do to voluntarily choose to focus, to fill your minds with what is true, with what is good, and with what is beautiful? I just want to say something about dementia, because as we were talking about it earlier in the discussion, that dementia has replaced cancer as the disease which people are most frightened about. And that includes particularly Christians. In fact, I think evangelical Christians are often particularly frightened about dementia. And that's because we put a great deal of emphasis on faith and on what you know and believe in your mind. And what's going to happen if my mind starts to go? What's going to happen if I sort of forget that Christ died for my sins? What's going to happen if I become confused and have a personality change and forget everything that Jesus has meant in my life? Am I going to lose my faith? Am I going to be lost forever? So I think there's a particular reason why evangelicals often worry about dementia. And I think the important thing to realize is that if you go back to what it means to be human, as the baby is being born, growing in the womb, it's God who sees and knows that baby. It's God and see you and knew you and loved you even when you were a tiny speck like Jesus in the womb. And God has known you and loved you and sustained you from that very moment. Long before you were aware of God, God saw you and God knew you. In fact, I think that actually God knew your name. God knew who you were and he called you into existence. He knew you from before the foundation of the world, but he created you and he called you into existence. And he knew that you would be sitting here listening to me at this particular time. Every moment of our days was written before one of them came to be. And that God who has known you and loved you and called you and holds you is going to carry on knowing and loving you and holding you, and whatever happens in the future, whatever happens to my brain, whatever happens to my neurotransmitters, even if I go and have another severe psychotic episode, pray God I don't, but I might, I know that the real John Wyatt is held and loved and known and is utterly secure in the love of God. And that's true for you as much as it is true for me. Whatever happens in the chances and the contingencies of life, whatever happens to my brain and to my conscious awareness, my memory, my personhood is secure in the eternal knowledge and the covenant love of God who is faithful. And I will always be me. I'm held secure in the unchangeable reality of God and his purposes, which stretch from before the foundation of the world to the life of the ages. So I don't need to worry that I'm going to be somehow lost. And even if, so we say by faith that the person, I sometimes hear people say something like, when someone's developed dementia, you know, that's not my mother. My mother died 5 years ago. That's just a thing in the bed. I understand why people say that, but they're wrong. It's not true. The person is still there, but what has often happened is that we've lost the ability to communicate with them. It's that they're locked into their own world. And part of the thing that we need to learn, therefore, is, and this is really happening, there are people who are developing lots of expertise in the care of people with dementia, including the spiritual care of people with dementia. But one incident that happened to me, a friend of mine, her father had been a great man of faith and a man of prayer. But he developed dementia, and he'd become increasingly mute and often just sat in the sofa slumped there, not saying anything. And he was in the sofa, my friend was caring for him, his daughter. And he was staring at the television, and there was a program, it was Songs of Praise, and it happened to be about prayer. And on an impulse, my friend said to her dad, "Do you still pray, Dad?" And he said, "Yes." And he hadn't spoken for days. And she said to him, "What do you say to God when you pray?" There was a long pause, and he said, "I say, hello." And that was it. And I thought, actually, that's pretty profound, isn't it? I mean, what more do you need to say to God than hello? And it also made me think, actually, how do we know what is happening spiritually deep down inside someone who has developed dementia? I mean, we're so intellectual and cerebral, we think that unless people are praying in terms of theology and quoting verses to God, then they can't really have a relationship with God. Really? And I think actually it made me realize that somebody could be having a really profound, amazing relationship in the presence of God, which you know nothing about. It's just they can't communicate it. But one of the ways of making contact with people with Alzheimer's disease, particularly who've had a spiritual past, is by things from their spiritual past. And that means it's very often verses from the authorized version of the Bible. It's things like hymns, ancient and modern, and the old stuff, the old Billy Graham hymns, or whatever the things were that meant a great deal to them. And what you can sometimes find, particularly through music, through singing and so on, is that you get a way in, a window of making contact with the person. Sometimes the window is very short, but it happens. My uncle has got very severe dementia, and most of the time he's being cared for him. We've arranged for him 24-hour nursing care and live-in carer, 24-hour. He's having in his own home, in his own flat, single man. And most of the time he's completely out of it. But the carer told me just fairly recently that there was an episode when he suddenly seemed with it, and he looked around and he said, people are caring for me, aren't they, in this flat, and people are paying for this, and I've arranged all this. And he said, I want you to tell them that I'm very grateful. I've probably forgotten this in the morning, but I want you to tell them I'm grateful. And then he sort of lapsed back. So it's interesting, isn't it? You get these little windows of contact, and you never know when they're going to come, but there are ways that we can do to improve those contacts. So how do we care for people with dementia? Well, with love, with compassion, with sensitivity. When I'm forgetting who I am, I need you to remind me, and I need you to remind me what's important to me. When I can't pray for myself, I need to know that you're going to pray for me. I need you to reassure me that I'm safe and that you'll always love me and that you won't abandon me. And you know, when we care for a person who has dementia with this kind of respect and with love and compassion, we're pointing towards the future. We're saying, this is not the end of the story. There's more going on here than you recognize. Because by God's grace, we know that this person is going to be raised. C.S. Lewis has a wonderful bit where he says, if you could see your neighbor as they're going to be in the new heaven and the new earth, you would either see someone of such glory and beauty and wonder that you would be tempted to bow down and worship them, or you will see a being of such horror that you will shrink from them. There are no ordinary people. You've never met an ordinary person. So when we treat this person whose body is a wreck, who seems so disabled and so destroyed by sin and disease, when we treat them with respect and with love, we're actually pointing towards the future. We're saying this is not the end of the story. And so we've got to care for people, not just because of what they once were. My father was very keen that the people who were caring for my mother in the home where she was should have pictures of her, of how she was when she was running a nursery school, and so that they wouldn't just see the person with all the problems in the bed. Yes, it's important that we care for people because of what they once were, but we also care for people in the light of what, by God's grace, they're going to be. We care for them now with dignity and with respect. And so, just as we said before, Christian love is a way of saying to another, it's good that you exist, it's good that you're in the world. So I just want to finish just again from a medical bit, and that is just know the signs of clinical depression. I think everybody ought to know this. This is sort of basic first aid, psychiatric first aid. The important signs of clinical depression are physical signs. It's not so much what someone is saying about what's going on in their heads and that they feel terrible and they're bored and they're depressed and they're down and all that. What's important are the physical signs. They're the signs of loss of appetite, loss of sleep, loss of interest in life and work and relationships, a sort of loss of motivation, which is quite different from grieving or sadness. It's a kind of blunting, a kind of apathy. And then suicidal thoughts. And the most important question that you need to ask is, have you ever thought of harming yourself? And sometimes people say, oh, no, it's not, never crossed my mind. But somebody might say, well, actually, I've been hoarding tablets and I've found a place on the car park where I could throw myself off, and I go there several times and I think about it and I haven't done it yet, or I've just worked out how I can throw myself under a train. You'd be amazed at how some people, they wouldn't say it unless you ask them. That's why you need to ask people, have you ever thought of harming yourself? And if they have, then that's a medical emergency and you need to get professional help straight away. And if someone refuses to get to the doctor, then you say, well, I'm going to come with you. I'll make an appointment and you can come with me. So that's the sobering end of the talk, but just to say that you could save a life, because unfortunately people do commit suicide. And just recently we know of two cases of quite young people, Christian people, in the church who've committed suicide with devastating effects. So this is an important topic. It's one that we need to support. We need to bear one another's burdens. But just to close, there's nothing that can happen which God cannot, in some sense, redeem and turn into blessing and healing. Thanks very much.
Thank you, John. Can I just clarify?